Salutations, Mets fans, and welcome to this week's edition. For all you kids out there, the official podcast of your baseball prospectus Mets local site. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro, and with me once again this week is Jarrett Seidler. Jarrett, been a long week for me. Been to a lot of baseball games.
Same here.
I pick one night to go to bed early, and I wake up to, and in case you missed it, of you agitating for a Tim Tebow call-up.
Okay, so I wasn't agitating for a Tim Tebow call-up. What I was saying was that out of the options that they have, Tim Tebow is a plausible call-up on merit. He's something like the fourth, he's probably something like the fourth or fifth best option behind, you know, Matt Dendecker.
Sip my ginger ale. We're in Jarrett's apartment again, by the way.
Jeff McNeil is probably a better option.
Yeah.
Ty Kelly, Phil Evans.
Sure.
But he's in the mix with those. I mean, he's an above average. He's hitting above league average in double A. And when you're hitting above league average in double A for a team that has absolutely no depth at your position, you're in the mix. That's all I'm saying is he's in the mix.
This is episode 108 for all you kids out there. There'll be more Tim Tebow discussion in the second half of the show as we'll go over some of the prospects we've seen and what's been a very, very busy week for us behind home plate.
Yeah.
But in the first half of the show, we will discuss the last week in Mets baseball, which we have not watched much of, but I don't think that's going to be disqualifying.
Yeah, and in the third half of the show, we have listener correspondence, and I guess we'll discuss All In a little bit.
Because we are both All In here.
Yes, we are one of the lucky 10,400 that actually have tickets for the show, and not one of the lucky, unlucky thousands and thousands that apparently couldn't get tickets.
There are probably going to be good tickets available for the Mets homestead next week, based on how they're playing.
Well, they got the big Han Solo Star Wars promotion on Saturday night, so they'll at least get like 30,000 in for that, assuming decent weather, but oh boy.
Not a great week.
Yeah, I mean.
So let's review some of the highlights, shall we? There was a Matt Harvey trade.
They got Devin Mesoraco at neutral salaries, which I think it's pretty good.
It's, I mean, they needed a catching upgrade, and Mesoraco is probably that with significant upside beyond that. Whether that actually works out or not is yet to be seen, but
right, and, you know, worst case, he's a backup catcher with some pop, which at least matches Kevin Pulecki better than Jose Lobaton does.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's similar to Harvey. He's been an All-Stars recently, which is a few years ago, and had some... His injuries have mostly been hip and back injuries, but he also ran into Tucker Barnhart actually turning out to be good.
Yeah, and I mean hip and back injuries for a catcher are not what you want.
But as you've seen, you know, not great plate discipline.
Yeah.
He's got some power. He's a decent defender.
He's a better major leaguer right now than Tomas Nito, and didn't cost him any more than
right,
Harvey.
I mean, functionally, this is a player that's probably about 90% of Travis d'Arnaud.
Sure.
It's a very similar skill set. So when you lose Travis d'Arnaud, this is what you go out and get. And to get them to eat all the money, you know, you probably would have been trading maybe a bottom of the top 10, a top of the 10 to 15 type prospect.
Yeah.
I think that's better than what we assumed that Harvey would return, if Harvey would return anything.
Yeah. And his first start in L.A. went pretty good. By Matt Harvey in 2018 standards.
I watched some of it. It was weird. I didn't actually want to watch, like I didn't want to watch the entire thing. It was just weird.
Sure.
It's like seeing your ex-girlfriend out on a date or something.
Yeah, I guess. I didn't watch it either because I don't remember what night it was. I think it was the night I went to bed early. But
you've also been dating and married to the same person for like 10 years. So.
12 and a half.
So, perhaps not the best metaphor for you. but, yeah, I mean, it wasn't... You know, he was 92-95 with, you know, kind of a slurvy slider, and the command was a little bit. Yeah, and they only let him pitch 4 innings, so he didn't run out of gas like he'd been running out of gas. And he was pitching on tons of extra rest.
Yeah, and now it's over. It's all done.
Right, and, you know, he'll pop up and, you know.
Who knows?
Sounds like, for the most part, most of the people around the team kind of, like, wish him the best.
At least publicly, yeah.
Yeah. you know, Mickey Callaway said he texted him.
Sure.
Yeah. I think, like, Jerry Blevin said he gave him a phone call, and a couple other guys did. It, you know, he wasn't, like, a hated nuclear bad clubhouse presence, except maybe towards the very end, when the situation just got a little out of control. The situation didn't really get out. You know, the Mets let the situation get out of control.
They did.
They brought him in with no plan other than he's just going to pitch well this time.
It is true.
They had no plan for what... They had no plan for him coming into spring training and looking like the same pitcher he looked like in 2017. And that became very clear, like, 2 weeks into spring training. Like, does he have a rotation spot locked up? Well, maybe. You know, are we going to try him in the bullpen at some point? Who knows? And then, you know, they cut him after 6 starts, basically. So, that's the last this week in Matt Harvey for a while, I guess. Yeah.
So we might need to institute this week in Yoenis Cespedes' hamstring.
This is a guy with bulky legs.
Yeah.
They knew he had bulky legs when they gave him $110 million.
Sure.
They knew he had bulky legs when they gave him $80 million the time before that. I remember he injured at the game we were at, and we saw him doing it. And I remember he was on the double play beat out.
Yeah.
He tweaked his quad on that. And we were remarking like that entire game, like he has it when he has to, but
seems to be the case. And you know, bad weather in Philly the last few days. And
it's 10-day disabled list.
It is literally a 10-day DL.
Even when Jay Bruce was on paternity leave, you can still run out of Conforto Lagares Bruce, or Conforto Lagares Nimmo. That's a representative major league outfield.
Sure.
You need to open up playing time. You've been talking about wanting to open up playing time for Lagares and Nimmo for 2 months anyway.
And of course, now you're in a situation where you have 2 days off this week because of the two-game AL series, so you can even...
But the you know, he just looks compromised.
Yeah. He's still... You know, having an 800 OPS after starting right, he's the year fine like at the dog plate. Shit, but...
And one of the interesting things I've noticed about him is when he gets, like, these leg injuries, he tends to hit better for whatever reason.
Who knows?
You know, I don't know whether that could just be
noise. Yeah.
But it could also be some weird mechanical thing that we're not really qualified to talk about. Not that that ever stops us.
No. But we're probably just going to keep on keeping on until something...
Right, until he pops something, and then he's out 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And...
We start the cycle all over again.
You know, Conforto appears to have regained the majority of his playing time. He's been hotter recently. Which is, you know... Listen, we obviously were never concerned that he was not going to be a regular starter... But the idea that this is a player that for some reason they lose faith in quickly.
Yeah.
And they've consistently lost faith in quickly. And when we point that out, it's not to be assholes or to be overreactionary. It's just to point out that this is a player that they perhaps don't seem to think is as good as everybody else does.
You gotta train him for Jake Odorizzi, was it?
Right. Heyman floated the JT Real Muto trade.
Yeah. He's getting it from somewhere.
Right, and, you know, you can say whether that's a predilection against young players, or it might be about his personality, or, you know, hey, they might just, you know, internally they might have had lower reports on him than the player he ended up being, you know. If you want to find the lowest Michael Conforto report you're ever going to see, go in the BP Prospect Archives. It's still there. You know? There were people that thought this guy was
regular.
Yeah, was a backup corner outfield first base kind of guy. Like, you know? Like, I don't even know what that guy is, because that guy really isn't around the majors anymore. Like, Matt Adams. Like,
yeah,
a worse Matt Adams or something like that. That was not a particularly unpopular opinion, and as we've discussed, there was a discussion on Twitter about the value like the projected value of the 11th overall pick. Michael McFaurow was 10th overall pick. The 11th overall pick discussion was in the context of Dom Smith. Like, half of the guys picked where Michael Conforto does don't have substantial major league careers.
Yeah.
You know, they end up being fringe backups or not making it at all. So the idea that the 10th overall pick could just not be a dude is not, like, really crazy.
The Mets had 4 picks in that general range in a row and got Brandon Nimmo, Gavin Cecchini, Smith, and Conforto, and you've seen a fairly plausible range of outcomes there for that. Yeah.
Conforto's the all-star, Nimmo's probably the average regular, Smith, you know, maybe a little below that, and, you know, I don't know that Cecchini's destined to be an org guy, but they've been treating Cecchini like an org guy for a while.
Couple years now, yeah.
And you can get an org guy at the 10th pick. It's something that happens.
Go back and look through the Baseball Reference archives. They're there.
Right. It's probably a little more common with catchers and pitchers than it is
shortstops,
but it happens. So, you know, and it's, you know, we were just, we had a conversation earlier today with somebody. It's hard to break your, like, initial thoughts on a player.
Sure.
It can take years. And sometimes that's good and sometimes that's bad.
I will say that, like, specifically I'm just sort of looking at these four guys. Nimmo was basically the same player for me every time I saw him. And I think I probably, on the whole, maybe liked him a smidge more than the industry for most of that period.
And I probably liked him a smidge more than you.
Yeah.
You know, I always thought he was going to be a decent or good major league regular, going back to when he was in the Sally.
You know, Cecchini bounced around more for me. There were years I liked him, but by the time he got to Double A, it was pretty clear that he wasn't a shortstop.
Yeah, that's what killed it for me. I thought when he was in A-ball, I thought he was going to be able to play major league shortstop.
Yep, same. And sometimes you don't learn until the game speeds up a little bit.
Right, like, it was a fringy arm, but guys with fringy arms have been playing shortstop more and more recently. And then it went from a fringy arm to a nope arm. it just never really developed for him.
And Smith has been the same guy every time I've seen him, going back to A-ball.
Yeah, I think that's...
And Conforto looked... I didn't get a long look at him in Brooklyn. But, again...
I got one game in Brooklyn. I got one game, Binghamton and Trenton. It was a Thursday wraparound series, and I called up on Friday.
Yeah, and I got him, like, literally the week before that, where the entire Mets front office was there, too.
Right, I think he went, like, 0-for-3 with 2 strikeouts, but was, like... You could, like, tell, like, just based on, like, the athletic movement and, like, the swing and, like...
He smoked a few balls in the series I sat on.
Right. You could tell... Like, you can see... Guys can... There's, like, a... Like, I saw Bo Bichette, like, a month ago, and he looked bad.
Yeah.
But you can also see a guy go 0-for-4 or 3 strikeouts and still look good.
It is counterintuitive at times.
Right. And that obviously happens less than when you see a guy go 4-for-5 with, you know, 2 doubles and a home run. But I've also seen guys go 4-for-5 with 2 doubles and a home run and not look like dudes either. Like, you know, or guys go off like that, too. Yeah, I mean, I guess the Dom Smith call-up was just, I assume, because he was on the 40 and they kind of needed Phil Evans to play, like, middle infield in AAA.
Sure.
And because Cecchini got hurt. Cecchini, I guess, was going to be the call-up. I'd get Jeff McNeil up here.
Yeah, baby, you're ruining my second half of the show thoughts.
Yeah, I've been the Jeff McNeil stan since, like,
2013. No, go fuck yourself, man. I was on him in Kingsport, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and you talk about a guy that, you know, maybe there's a little more untapped projection there, and maybe he's going to learn to uppercut it. I'm going to take the guy that was a nationally ranked golfer.
He was stomped, and he hit three. I guess we're talking about Jeff McNeil now. Yeah. He hit three foul balls that just missed home runs, and two were fucking moonshots. And the third one was just a laser beam, like 22-degree launch angle or whatever.
Right, so the problem with Jeff McNeil when he was in A-ball, aside from getting hurt constantly.
Yeah.
which probably actually plays into that, is he had a golfer's build.
Yes.
He had the build of a junior golfer. He no longer has the build of a junior golfer.
He looks like a, you know, normal, average baseball player type physique. He's not quite as jacked as he was 2 years ago in Binghamton, right before he tore every muscle in his lower body, basically.
But this is also a dude that's 26 and might be able to help the major league team.
Sure, yeah, and they
kind of need to get him up.
They played him in some corner outfield recently. He's pretty good at second. He can probably still spot you at short in a pinch. You know, he's maybe just sort of the better version of Ty Kelly.
Right. So I'd rather call that up instead of Ty Kelly or Phil Evans. They did call up Luis Guillorme.
Yeah.
Who, in his first game, scored his first major league run, and his first at bat, had his first major league hit. You know, we obviously like Luis Guillorme. I don't know him personally. I don't think you know him personally either.
I interviewed him once many years ago.
I interact with his dad on social media.
As do we all, basically.
Yeah, you know, his dad's basically a member of Mets Twitter.
Essentially, yes.
Seems like a really nice guy from what I can tell. You know, Luis Jr. seems like a really nice kid.
Are you
getting
to the point where he should be the backup infielder over Jose Reyes at this point?
That's been true for probably a calendar year, right?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, for what? For the positions you're basically asking that role to cover, which are essentially second, third, and short.
Right.
Just on, like, whatever you think about their relative offensive profiles at this point in time. And I think you can make a case Guillermes is better. I'm not sure if that's necessarily true, but you can certainly make a case. The defensive gap alone is...
So the argument...
Insurmountable, Reyes, at this point in his career.
The argument is that Guillorme is, what, 23?
Yeah.
And he's still developing substantially offensively. And if you stick him in that role, it might stun his development. And they think he might be a major league regular.
Sure. And he's also a young player they're probably never going to give that opportunity to full-time, because they haven't really...
Right. But, you know...
He'll eventually get, you know, shunted into the Wilmer Flores role once Wilmer Flores hits free agency or something.
But there's situations under which Luis Guillorme is, like, the starting second baseman next year.
There are, yeah.
And they probably don't involve him sitting on the bench and only getting 100 more bats for the rest of the season.
Sure.
So I can kind of see that. The problem is it's just not hard to get a utility infielder better than that. They already have one. His name is Wilmer Flores.
It's true.
You know.
And that's, I think, also sort of the argument for carrying a Jeff McNeil on the spot, because there is actual probably outfield utility there, and he's still probably a better defender than Jose Reyes at the positions he's going to be asked to play.
And, you know, Phil Evans basically plays the same for catcher in an emergency, which, when you have two bad catchers and would like to hit for them, except your manager's a big scaredy pants, and won't hit for them until the ninth inning, or sometimes not even in the ninth inning, as they did not today.
Devin Mesoraco against Sir Anthony Dominguez.
Well, here's my Mets tie-in. The Mets just don't do this.
That's true.
Like, the Mets... if this guy was in the Mets system, he'd be starting games in high A right now. Maybe double A.
That is very true.
Maybe double A. You know? They just don't... You know, they... Here's even my other thing. I think Sir Anthony Dominguez is going to end up as the Phillies closer in both the medium and long term. So I don't think this is where this is going. But for his development, if you wanted him to be your number three starter in 2020, I would still rather have him in the major league bullpen than the high A rotation.
Because you're going to get value out of it.
You're going to get value out of it. He's going to learn how to pitch the big leaguers. He's going to develop more. The idea that you can't use... This is something that Earl Weaver used to love breaking in pitchers like this. Tony La Russa used to love breaking in pitchers like this. The Yankees have done it forever. Traditional good teams have always broken in their starting prospects, and not always, but have been willing to break their starting prospects in relief. Even when they're, quote, not ready.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when Alex Reyes got called up in 2016. Alex Reyes is not ready to contribute to the major leagues. Command in the Pacific Coast.
That's like 35 innings at like a 2 ERA.
Right.
Pitching like 2-3 innings since, as I recall.
Right, and he started a couple of games late. And they're going to bring him back as a reliever this year, because they feel that the best path for him to be a starter in 2020 is to be a reliever right now.
Yeah. And they're still building up arm strength after Tommy John, too, so...
Adam Wainwright did not start the 2006 NLCS Game 7. They were using him as the fucking closer.
No, Carlos Martinez started in the bullpen, too.
Right. And the Mets just don't... And when they do it, it's in, like, these weird half-ass Rafael Montero...
Seth Lugo.
Right.
It's accidental. They need a starter, so they just grab...
Right. Like, you know... The equivalent to this isn't Robert Gesellman in the bullpen in 2018. It's Robert Gesellman in the bullpen in July 2016.
Yeah.
That's you know... Because somebody's going to mention Robert Gesellman or Seth Lugo. We're not talking about Robert Gesellman or Seth Lugo. We're talking about... I mean, fuck, they really don't have a... we're talking about them sticking Justin Dunn in the Major League bullpen in, like, July.
Yeah.
Hypothetically, you know, if he ends up coming back healthy and continuing to pitch like he has. And they just don't do that, and the Phillies have shown some willingness.
They have almost no double-A pitching prospects right now at all in the starting rotation, so...
Sure. But, you know, even with their, quote, relief prospects, like, you know...
Why is Ty Bashler still in double-A? Why is Eric Hanhol still in double-A?
You know, they called Gerson Batista up for an emergency look. There's a passivity there.
Sure. There's, you know, David Peterson and Anthony Kay are still in A-ball.
Right. Yeah. They waited a long time to call up Ahmed Rosario last year. A long time. For, like, no particularly good reason. And, you know, maybe if Ahmed Rosario had another 100 Major League at-bats, he'd be adjusting the breaking balls a little better. Maybe his fanny wouldn't be out. So far.
Maybe his back foot would actually have some leg drive in his swing, yes.
Right. So, see, that wasn't actually a Phillies prospect point. It was a point.
They're all Phillies prospect segments. Do you have any other Mets stuff from this week of note? We want to talk a little bit about Jason Vargas.
He sucks.
Well, yes, thank you.
But, I mean, it's not like, and again, you know, Jason Vargas has had a long and distinguished Major League career. Jason Vargas was an all-star last year.
Sure.
Jason Vargas is a pitcher in his late 30s who had very little margin of error.
Yeah.
And appears to have hit the margin of error.
Now on the other side of the margin, yes.
Right.
And we said, you know, it's, I think we discussed it even at the time of the signing. Like, it could be that his second half of 2017 was just a little bit of fatigue coming off his first full season with Tommy John, or it could just be, this guy's done now.
And in previous incarnations of free agency, you can debate whether this year's free agency was actually different. Like, giving Jason Vargas $16 million to find out whether he's still a good pitcher or not is, like, not horrible.
Yes.
The problem is that the Mets are going to keep starting him because they don't understand the idea that once you've made that determination that Jason Vargas is horrible, just exile him to the bullpen, or... You know, come up with a fake injury, so instead of pitching a sim game while on the Major League roster, you can extend Buddy Bauman's stay in the majors.
Shoulder fatigue. Back tightness, it's always a good one.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, he's in his 30s like me, I'm sure he probably has a tight back most days.
I've had one for weeks now. Horrible to sleep with.
I guess that's the first half of the show. It wasn't a really exciting week.
No, I mean... Well, Franmil Reyes is getting called up. The Padres are doing some interesting shit.
Do we have a G-chat from Craig about that yet?
No, I saw it on there.
No.
Zach Kreiser actually posted it on Twitter.
Alright, let me G-chat him.
Yeah.
While I'm doing that, we'll take a break. We come back, we'll go in deeper on prospects other than Jeff McNeil, and possibly some Phillies prospects, though maybe not because they're too much on the Lakewood roster.
We can talk about Spencer Howard.
Oh, that's right, because there'll be stuff. All right. Jared and I have both been to a bunch of games this week. I even covered a...
One of the same game.
One of the same game. We got rained out today.
Supposed to be two.
But I did actually get to see the Binghamton Mets earlier this week in Hartford.
You already gave us your Jeff McNeil thoughts.
I did. I mean, I'd probably for him if you want to grade. He's like on the 3-4 line, depending on what you
That's
think about
always
the.
I mean, it's always
yeah, but that
for me.
What you think about the age relative to league at this point? How much really buy into the power? How much positional flexibility you think he has? Yeah, the line between threes and fours
is blurry.
It can be blurry. There's another guy that blurred the line for me, and not exactly one I was expecting in 2018, the year of our Lord.
Mickey Moniak?
No, I didn't see Mickey Moniak this week. Yoan Urania, of all people. Like, sometimes, I'm not foring him, to be clear. Sometimes you see a guy, and he just, like, he shows good, and it's just like, oh, I'm seeing a good weekend for a competent upper minors player.
Yeah, I
like
mean,
Victor Cruzado did this to me in St. Lucie a few years ago, where it's like just that he just had like the weekend of his life. He had a couple home runs, made a diving catch in center, threw a guy out when he played right.
I had like Luke Williams, who's a semi-pro, who's like a 3 in the Phillies system. They might not even be a 3. He's like he's a borderline 2-3 in the Phillies system. Like had like 5 game-winning hits for me last year.
But with Urania, like it looked. Like, because I saw him in Brooklyn, of course, and I liked him then, as I think everyone did in 2014, and then he triple-repeated St. Lucie or whatever it was.
Well, he skipped...
You skipped Savannah and then triple-repeated St. Lucie. Yeah. That's right, because I was supposed to be in St. Lucie that year, and he was hurt when I was there.
Yeah, all kinds of weird injuries.
The body's not as bad as I expected it to be at this point, but it's not great. He's playing corner outfield, I think, because they want Matt Obersi's bat in the lineup, so they have to put him at third. I have to imagine Yoan Urania is still a better third baseman than Matt Obersi at this point.
Can I... Where would you say his median outcome is compared to, like, Jeffrey Marte's career to date? Is it, like, right on?
No, Marte is better.
Okay, so we're below Jeffrey Marte.
We're below Jeffrey Marte. I mean, Marte is like a 4 platoon corner guy. I can't quite
get... So you got Urania a little bit below that, okay.
He's a switch hitter. He showed good power after the oppo gaps from both sides. And that's not like the Rockies or affiliate there. The Yard Goats has some decent
I mean, this is also... Pitchers. This is a pretty common player archetype.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, we see these guys.
I figured I was just going to see like an easy 2 at this point in his career.
Like, there's a kid on the blue calls like Jake Shiner who could do this kid in 2 years.
Yeah, that's actually not a bad comp. Yeah, because it's like
there's a kid on the West Virginia third baseman could be this kid in a couple of years.
He's like he's like a medium power. Still has issues with spin. Like it's just like I don't know. It's like I kind of liked it.
Right.
I wasn't expecting to like it. I'm not 4 him. I think it's a 3, but I was a little bit more there than I thought was expecting.
You've basically confirmed everybody else is Peter Alonso crap.
Yeah, so Peter Alonso.
Peter Alonso crap from last year.
They've done a nice job with the swing. They lowered his hands. They shortened everything. They closed him off.
Longer steps foot in the bucket.
No, he's pretty straight on. He didn't get overly pull heavy. It was a little bit of a 2-strike approach there, too, where he didn't try to do too much. He doesn't have to sell out for the power. I saw him hit a bunch of singles.
So here's the thing. He's a 55 or a 6 hitter with 7 power. He's a star.
Yeah.
If he's a 45 hitter with 6 power, he's a platoon guy that might not be in the majors. And there really isn't a whole lot of difference between those.
Yeah.
Those are both very possible outcomes for this player.
Because, like, 45 with 60 power is basically, like, right Lucas Duda.
Right.
And, like, right-handed Lucas Duda is a tougher sell than left-handed Lucas Duda.
You know, 6 hit, 7 power is, like, Rhys Hoskins.
Yeah.
And this was why Rhys Hoskins was so tough to evaluate. The difference between Rhys Hoskins and, I mean, fuck it, Jeffrey Marte.
Sure.
Just isn't that big.
It's true.
You know, this is why these guys are the tough guys to evaluate.
And the thing with Alonso, too, it's like, so there's been a lot of people.
I mean, don't get me wrong, the difference in value between Rhys Hoskins and Jeffrey Marte is 6 wins or whatever. But the difference in actual tools there is much less substantial than it is the difference between Francisco Lindor and Yulieski the crappy Kansas
Betancourt.
Yeah. You know, that's the we're talking differences of 4 grades across the board versus differences of, you know, a grade here and a grade and a half there.
Yes. So I know there's been a lot of people clamoring him to call him up, or at least bump him to AAA at this point. I wouldn't do that. Because, like, the specific things he needs to work on, I think he's better off sticking around. It's basically, he freezes a little on spin, he doesn't see it great, and the defense is still a... I know the Mets are definitely putting it out there that it's not a problem anymore. It's still a problem.
They're not putting it out there that it's not a problem anymore. They're putting
it's,
out
it's greatly better. It is better.
It is better.
It's just, yeah.
This was a guy that he was the best prospect on Binghamton's team last year at the end of the season in the playoffs, where they should have been condensing the playing time to help the best prospect. That's what you often do, unless you're, you know, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you just have those guys there for the experience. But he was playing.
Yeah.
And they were DHing him behind Matt Oberste.
Well, they're now playing him first, so Matt Oberste can play third, which is also what I mean. He battles. I'll give Matt Oberste credit. He fucking battles at third base.
We have a presentation that's up for Sabre Seminar, and if it gets into it, we'll be discussing the minor leagues in much greater detail in both an article and a PowerPoint and a presentation. But one of the things you realize when you start to look at what the minor leagues are is that you need the Matt Oberstes, otherwise the entire fucking thing falls apart how it's done. You know, you need these guys that'll go out there and just, like, soak up playing time and, you know, give you a representative performance and, you know, sign baseballs for kids before the games.
He can still hit. He's always been able to hit a little bit.
Right, you know, and they're not... Matt Oberste in a double-A scenario looks fine. It feels fine.
Yeah.
He'll probably play in triple-A for 5 or 6 years.
Sure.
Again, maybe not the optimum of what you were hoping for when you drafted that player at that spot. And I think he got 6 figures, right?
I think he was, like, 6th round, I think.
Yeah.
5th or 6th, I don't remember.
You know, you're kind of still hoping with that pick to get a major league contributor, and he's probably not going to be one.
Yeah.
90-95% not going to be that guy. But you also need these guys. Yep. And
it's the very old scouting cliche. You need the 25 guys to give the 3 guys that are actually going to be major contributors games to play in.
Right, like you mentioned, West Virginia's utility infielder played for the University of Hartford last year and was the best player.
Yeah.
And now he's a 5th infielder in low A.
Yeah.
What round was he drafted in?
20-something.
Right, so... 23rd. Is he a senior or junior?
He's a junior.
Right, so, yeah, you know, this was like he probably got like 75, 100,000. And, you know, he'll probably have...
He might get to, you never know. I thought, like, when I saw him, I'm like, he's gonna be... He'll get to a Florida State League.
Right.
Don't know if he'll get to Double-A, but...
The ecostructure, the way it's designed, needs these guys to work. Now, there's a great discussion about whether you should just change the ecostructure, and that's the discussion we want to have.
Right. And I also say, too, that I absolutely would have submitted him for the draft off my looks last year.
Sure.
Knowing that this was probably
because of
these guys.
Yeah. We mentioned, I think we've outed the pitcher before. We saw Adam Atkins in Brooklyn and we're like, how the hell did this guy get drafted? Well, now we're sitting here a couple years later and Adam Atkins is still getting outs a couple levels up.
Yeah.
He got drafted because you need guys to get outs.
Yeah.
You know? Because at some point, you just need guys to pitch innings and get outs.
I mean, the dude we saw starting for West Virginia on Saturday was...
was like an 89 command and control right-hander. And that dude went, what, 7 innings and threw 60 pitches or whatever?
You know, a little feel for the slider and change weren't awful. They were below average, but...
But that's also what you see now, you know, guys that would have been... fringe prospect talents 10 years ago are now those guys.
Yeah.
Because everybody throws 95 a slider now. I saw Spencer Howard, who was the Phillies' 2nd round pick last year. I rolled him up by the time, I'm assuming this is probably going to open Monday. By the time most of you listen to this, he'll be in the 10-pack. I think, unless, you know, Craig never actually confirmed that, but whatever. Yeah, he hasn't yelled at me for it, so I think I said it to him.
Yeah.
You know, this is when you take a pitcher in the top 50 or 60 picks out of college and give him seven figures, this is what you hope he looks like in A-ball.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fastball. You know, he was... A saying you will hear every scout say is that the opposing team will tell you how a guy's actually playing.
Yeah.
The swings will tell you. The pitches will, you know, the swings and misses will tell you. And, I mean, like, aside from a couple hanging curveballs, they just couldn't, they couldn't pick them up. And this was a Charleston team that has a lot of name value, high signing bonus Latin American kids. Oswaldo Cabrera, Wilkerman Garcia, Leonardo Molina.
Yeah, all those guys.
Yeah. All the guys. So the interesting thing is, if they were really guys,
yeah,
they'd be in high A already, you know, based on age for the most part. I kind of like Oswaldo still.
I like
Oswaldo,
too.
Yeah, he made some... He's basically sharing the middle infield with Wilkerman, and I kind of like them better at both spots.
Yeah.
And he just kind of has a little more kind of feel for the game. You know, he hung a couple curveballs. One of them was the Leonardo Molina.
Yeah.
Hit it off of the wall. When he was burying the curveball, it was a good pitch for him. He threw a couple sliders. They were... He was just throwing sliders, basically.
He's a recent starting pitching convert, too.
He threw a couple change-ups. It was like... It basically felt like they told him to throw five sliders and five change-ups. You know that happens.
Well, no, too, because also he teaches throwing fastball curve. It's like,
right,
what's he even doing at this level?
Right, so... But, you know, he was... You know, with the fastball, he's beating guys high, he's beating guys low, he's got good plane. You know, he's got some nice run to it. I saw Caleb Jones again, who I wrote up a couple of weeks ago. You know, and it's just... I'm never going to not find it notable when, like, a lefty starter is sitting 94 to 96 with, like, a usable slider.
Yeah.
Like, that, there's just... That, you know... I don't know how to write that guy up, either. This is why I'm not a scout. Like, what do you submit that guy as? I mean, the generic is you submit him as, like, a 45.
Yeah, sure.
Just to, like, split the baby, but you're splitting the baby. The Yankees had some pitchers that on paper looked interesting and, like, all weren't, like, at all. Doesn't mean they won't be in the future. It's
sure.
Still May, and a lot of these guys are first year out of the draft.
My 10-pack this week was on Nabo Chrismat.
Sure.
Who is still Nabo Chrismat, but that's like one of, like, one of those things where he's still getting it done in AA, so you start to, like, wonder if he can...
Right, it's the same thing as the Tim Tebow discussion. Underlying the Tim Tebow discussion earlier is once a player is a decent AA player,
they're
pretty goddamn close to majors.
Yeah, and I think Nabo Chrismat's going to pitch in the majors. I don't know if he's going to be good, because he's 87, he's still, whatever, 87 to 91, sit 88 to 89, good command, some run.
But we talk about sometimes the hitters will tell you, and he has a long tendency of making hitters look really stupid.
He does.
And that's apparently continued in Double A.
There were not a lot of comfortable swings. He didn't get a lot of strikeouts. I mean, it appeared to me that he was working on his slider right on right. He was only throwing his change to his lefties. When he got in trouble, he started throwing the change to righties, and it was very effective, but I think he was working on the slider right on right, and it needs some work. It's a pitch that's developing, and I think it'll end up better than the curve against righties, but and it's always going to be a tough profile. He's a short righty with a below-average fastball and fringy breaking stuff that survives off that plus changeup. So, we'll see. But at
a
certain
God,
point...
Oh, God, Craig made a horrible pun.
Yeah, he'll do that. But at a certain point...
The Padres might well be on their way to a friendful outfield. Craig, come on, man. Come on, Craig. That's like...
Yeah, got nothing.
Yeah. Craig made a horrible pun.
I didn't even have anybody else on. Oh, I saw Ty Bachelor, and he was some two-seam run at the bottom end of the velocity. Pitches expective up. Good shape to the slurvy thing, although he wasn't really getting swings and misses on it in that look. Like high-end, late-inning, also, you know.
I've heard he's been very up and down this season from outside sources.
Yeah, the command was fine. And you know, whatever, came in and did his job. Adonis Uceta was, whatever. It was like 93, 94. Change was okay. Breaker's bad. It's, you know, it's
kind of pitching the mid.
Yeah, I don't see it. It's not a particularly interesting relief arm to me. And the annals of double-A relief arms, of which I have large books of in my phone at this point.
You know, I got a Redding Trenton series. Trenton's hitting's freaking terrible.
It didn't look great.
They're gonna get guys from high A in the DL later in the year, but they've got nobody right now. They've got interesting pitching because they've always got interesting pitching at double A. But I mean, like, they've got this kid Brian Keller, who was a 2016 39th round draft pick out of like a D2 school in like the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
He's not like special or anything. He's a four.
Yeah.
But he's a four.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Like you've magicked the four out of nowhere. You know,
he's have a 6-year major league career.
Right, he was like 89 to 92 with a nice slider and, you know, good command and, you know, threw a couple real good curveballs but wasn't throwing it very much. But that was like the pitch he was using, like, a curve as his out pitch. Threw a couple changes. So all of a sudden you're talking about four-pitch guy, command. You know, he's been higher in velocity previously.
Is he left-handed?
No, he's right-handed.
I was going to say, so it's right-handed Dietrich Enns then.
Right, yeah, exactly.
You love this guy, so...
It's not so much that I love this guy, but I marvel at the Yankees' ability to just, like, constantly come up with him, like, out of nowhere.
Sure.
Because you could also, you trade these guys. You know, you trade Taylor Widener and Nick Solak and get Brandon Drury back. Like, that's what you do. You know, Taylor Widener is another one of these guys.
Yep.
You know, they pulled him out of the South Carolina bullpen in the 13th round. I saw our old friend Harold Rouse.
Yeah.
For he's very
yeah.
87 to 89 with the cutter.
Yeah.
You know, he's still throwing the cutter, he's still throwing the curveball.
Yeah, he's in double A, good for him.
Yeah. He's pitching well. I saw Ranger Suarez right before he went on the DL. He was kind of makes sense now. He gassed in the fourth inning really badly, which was kind of a little weird for me. But he was all stages in his usual array of 26 different off-speed pitches. Redding doesn't really have any hitters either. You can still have hope for Mickey Moniak, I guess, at this point, although...
How do we even come on to Mickey Moniak, Jerry? I don't think you saw him this week.
No, but I want to talk about Cornelius Randolph.
Okay.
I don't think there's much hope left for Cornelius Randolph. He's hitting, like, an empty 190. The mechanics are just bad. It's
like, he's still relatively young for that level.
I think he's, like, 21.
Yeah.
But there was never, like, an athlete, you know. At least Moniak, you can say, was, like, a premium athlete.
Randolph was not.
Randolph's not a... Randolph was a guy that was going to have to hit 320 to be a star, and he can't hit 190 in the Eastern League and be a star based on your hit tool.
That's another conversation we had this weekend.
You know, guys that hit the majors usually hit the minors. They usually hit really well in the minors.
Yeah.
You know, and when they don't, there's a reason. And it's usually a really good reason, a really obvious reason. You know, sometimes, like, guys, like, you know, coming out of the draft are just gassed, or, like, first year out of Cuba adjusting to the environment or something like that. Or, you know, a 19-year-old kid stuck, you know, got double promoted to double A and struggles with, you know, spin. But, you know, hitters hit.
What they do. What we're going to do now is take a short break. When we come back, we will wrap up the show with the usual third half nonsense. Welcome back. Now it's time for the third half of the show. Before we do the third half of the show, we do housekeeping. Just for all you kids out there, episode 108. For all you kids out there, is the official podcast of your baseball prospectus Mets local site. You can find us on the internet at mets.locals.baseballprospectus.com or on the mothership at baseballprospectus.com. You can find the podcast on iTunes. Just search for all you kids out there. You can listen or subscribe right there. I encourage you to do both. I also encourage you to rate and review the podcast. If you want to get in contact with the show, we're on Twitter at For All You Kids. Jarrett's on Twitter at J.A. Seidler. I'm on Twitter at Jeff Paternostro. We have a Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/ForAllYouKidsOutThere. And you can email the show at allyoukids@baseballprospectus.com. No emails this week. We do have a couple Facebook queries. The first one's from Willie. Question for the pod. Would the Wilpons ever commit to a full teardown rebuild?
No.
I said that in the Facebook group. That was the short answer. We now have to give the long answer.
So they're like, if you're talking about full teardown rebuild like the Astros, they're just like too committed to like the back pages. And I don't even know if a team in New York could do that. Like, look at all this shit like the Philly like press gave the 76ers, and one, that's basketball, which, you know, I think the daily sports press cares about less than baseball, and two, it's Philadelphia and not New York. Like, I don't think they could get away with that.
I mean, I guess the counterexample to that is the Phillies rebuild in recent years, which...
Yeah, but they never, you know... Did they ever really totally bottom out?
The Phillies? And they were really bad, man.
You know, but they were always kind of... Like, they held on to Hamels long enough, you know... That by the time they finished the teardown, like, there was already, like, obvious hope on the horizon.
Yeah, because I guess you had, like, Nola and...
You know, Jared Eichhoff was already playing well in the majors by then. Odubel Herrera was already playing well in the majors by then.
I mean, they still, you know, did have the number one overall pick when they drafted Vicky Boniak, so...
That is true. You know, so I... But how different is what the Phillies did from what the Mets did in 2011, 2012, 2013? Probably more 11 and 12 than 13. 13, they were already starting to make kind of noises that they want to be competitive again.
Yeah, I mean, they did the Ari Dickey trade, obviously, which is the, you know, the rebuild trade. You cash in on the Cy Young winner with a year left on the deal. That,
right, I mean, it's the functional equivalent of the Cole Hamels trade for them. Yeah. Or, Houston never really made that kind of trade. They didn't really have that piece to trade.
They didn't. That was one of the problems they had when they started doing the rebuild, is they were selling off, like, Wandy Rodriguez. And
right.
I think the, what's his name? Brett Myers in there somewhere, too, I think.
Right.
Like, they didn't really have a...
Well, they got some of their useful pieces through trade.
Yeah.
But it was more of, like, the smaller kind of deal than the bottom-out kind of.
I mean, I guess the closest equivalent to what Willie's talking about would be the White Sox. Dealing Sale, Eaton, and Quintana in the space of, you know, a year, essentially.
The White Sox have just done that so often in their history that, like, their fans are, like, accustomed to it. In 2 days, I'm going to get a text from Nick Schaefer yelling at me about this. but, you know, the famous white flag trade in the late 90s. They've kind of always been either really pushing or But they also got, like, a huge haul back for those guys. Like,
yeah, but, I mean, the Mets could do the equivalent with Syndergaard, DeGrom, and Conforto.
But it's easier to sell when you've got Yan Moncada and he's already in the major leagues and he's already a good player in the major leagues. It's hard to sell Michael Conforto and get, like, I mean, what are you going to get? Like, teams aren't trading, like, I mean, what, you're going to trade Noah Syndergaard back to the Blue Jays for Vlad Jr.?
I don't think the Blue Jays would even do that trade now.
Right, exactly. You know, you're going to send Jacob DeGrom to the Nats for Juan Soto. I don't think the Nats would do that trade either. Teams are hugging these real top prospects a lot more closely.
Yeah, I mean, you might get a, I don't know.
Eloy Jimenez.
Would you even get Jimenez at this point?
I mean, he was literally in one of these deals last year.
No, I know. I'm just trying to think who the equivalent is now is the problem. Like, the problem is a lot of... Because there's so many teams... Because there's so many teams functionally not trying to compete, they've also stockpiled most of the top prospects in baseball right now.
Most of the top prospects are either on teams that aren't going to compete or teams that are trying to compete really cheaply.
Yeah. Which is probably why the Blue Jays aren't trading Vlad Jr.
Right.
Among other reasons. He's very good.
Yeah, if you go back to our updated May list, the Baseball Prospectus 101, Ryald Acuña is not getting traded. Victor Robles might get traded. Victor Robles is also hurt. The Mets aren't dumping huge pieces to the Nationals.
No.
Gleyber Torres is a major league starter. Vlad's going to be a major league starter soon. You know, the Indians would probably trade to Francisco Mejia.
Yeah, that's probably reasonable.
Eloy Jimenez is on a team that's tanking. Nick Senzel's on a team that's tanking, although they did just sweep the Dodgers. Alex Reyes is still in recovery. Fernando Tatis is on a team that's tanking. The Astros are just not fucking trading you, Forrest Whitley.
Really?
Yeah. They're not. Brandon Honeywell just had Tommy John. Brendan Rodgers? Yeah, you could probably get Brendan Rodgers for
the right piece. You might not want Brendan Rodgers right now for your top-tier piece, but...
Phillies ain't trading six, though.
They are not.
You know, J.P. Crawford's hurt. Tampa's never trading. Willie Adams is going to be right until he's traded for the next Willie Adams in 5 years. You know, Mitch Keller? Yeah.
I mean, the Pirates are trying to compete cheaply, so Mitch Keller is useful.
Michael Kopech's
that.
On a team that's tanking. Lou Brinson's on a team that's tanking. Bo Bichette? Yeah, you could probably get Bo Bichette.
Bo Bichette, really what you want.
Why are you trading Noah Syndergaard for Bo Bichette?
We both like Bo Bichette.
Sure. You know. Let's just start
looking. You can't get the pieces back to make it worth your while. Especially, you know, like,
maybe the Dodgers would trade you Alex Verdugo for one of these guys.
Especially the problem with, like, Syndergaard, especially in this point in the cycle, is you're trading so many years of control. Like, with DeGrom, at least.
And let's say you want to trade, you know, the Dodgers need a bat more than they need a pitcher, I think. And they love Michael Conforto.
Sure.
They trade you Alex Verdugo for Michael Conforto.
Yeah.
What's Michael Conforto in terms of Alex Verdugo's outcomes? Like, an 80th percentile outcome?
And
Michael Conforto starts... more potential left. Michael Conforto might have more room for growth than Alex Verdugo does. It's much easier to see Michael Conforto being a superstar on the pennant-contending 2020 Mets than is Alex Verdugo being a superstar on the pennant-contending 2020 Mets.
Yep.
And, you know, we both... I like Alex Verdugo.
Yeah, sure. He's a nice little player.
Right. You know, Alex Verdugo, looking for it.
Sure.
It's just not a very good chance. you know, that's sort of what you're getting, you know.
I mean, this is the nuts and bolts of it, but I think sort of the overarching question is, will they actually... Would.
Right, you know, would the Yankees trade you Esteban Florial in a Noah Syndergaard trade? Yeah, probably.
Probably.
Might even trade you Gleyber in a Noah Syndergaard trade.
They might. Cashman can be a little...
Right. To what end?
Yeah.
Right. There ain't Noah Syndergaard coming in the system.
No.
You know, maybe if you took, like, Matt Liberatore in number six.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he's four a guy that has now, that yeah. kind of upside and, you know, way down the road. Yeah. But that's, like, what you're talking about. You're, like, talking about some theoretical draft pick, theoretically 4 years down the road.
Yeah.
And they're probably not taking a pitcher anyway at that spot. You know, I know we haven't done too much draft talk. Probably due for a draft guest before the draft episode.
In a couple weeks. It's late this year.
Do you know anybody that actually likes to talk about the draft that that we could have on? If you have suggestions, please email us. We'll probably ignore them. We probably can't even talk about them. But if you have suggestions for a draft person, you know, we hear the same stuff everybody else hears about the sixth pick and then don't really pay attention to picks after that. I mean, I've heard connections with them in the second round, but...
Benjamin wants to know, who would you rather have in your 25-man roster, Matt Harvey or Jason Vargas?
In what role?
I mean, I think just... in general.
Jason Vargas.
Yeah, I think you can probably get some value out of the pen, even if it doesn't. We know Matt Harvey can't pitch out of the pen.
Jason Vargas is also willing to do pretty much whatever you tell him to do, which sure. Harvey was not, and that was part of the problem. Your sixth best starting pitcher has to be able to understand that he's your sixth best starting pitcher, which I think Vargas does, and Harvey does not. You know, if I was the Reds, I'd rather have Harvey.
Sure.
Because, you know, the Reds are going nowhere this season. And, you know, maybe you turn him around, they can flip him for a prospect. You're not flipping Jason
Vargas. Or maybe
Vargas
he gets comfortable there and gives you priority for a one-year deal next year where you can...
Sure.
Same thing.
Sure. Yeah. There's more reasonable upside there.
John has a question for the pod. Rate the beers at Icarus Brewery. Side
oh, yeah, yeah, we read it. We read it. Yeah. So we read it to my old friend Jay, who participates in the podcast stuff. What do you have there?
I had the Not a Schooner, which is a juicy, like, New Englandish IPA. It's quite good.
Yeah.
I actually have a whole growler of the Saison in the fridge, which I should be drinking, but as you can tell, I have a bit of a throat thing right
yes,
now.
Please remember to take that with you, by the
yes,
way.
Yes, yes, I will.
I had a pint of the Shandy, which was pretty good.
Of course you did.
It was...
Very on... It's all very on brand.
Yeah, I didn't feel like having anything heavy, so... That seemed like a nice light alternative. It's a nice place. I actually had... It, despite it being in an area that I drive by quite frequently, I'd actually never been there before.
That's a nice little setup.
Yeah, it was a nice, there's a lot of those places around here now.
I know, same up where I am, it just is,
right,
the,
I mean, there's one literally that, you know, we've been to the one down the street. You know, there's basically one every, like, 10 miles now. They did do something kind of interesting to get around the, so New Jersey has
yeah,
basically...
Yeah.
Three rules for tap rooms at breweries, which I have a friend of mine owns one, so I know these. I've had these discussions. One is that you can't play live sporting events.
Yeah. Which is so weird, but...
Two is that you have to, like, visibly offer tours in
yes.
the brewery, because technically this whole thing is part of a tour you're drinking.
Yes,
in.
Yes.
Yes, it's like this ridiculous thing. And the other, and the third rule, which is the one that's applicable here, is you can't serve hot food.
Yes.
So they had a food truck parked in the parking
lot.
Yeah.
My favorite is when we went to where you walked in, they just had a map of the brewery. Like,
yes,
you, like a little thing around that counted as your tour.
Yeah, that's, which I thought was a cute way of getting around. But that's, oh, what the hell is the name of that place? John Campbell Brewing in Tinton Falls. Who also does a nice job. Yeah, I mean, I would go back to Icarus after the Blue Claws game.
Sure. It was nice.
Yeah, it was a nice little setup. They had a lot of area.
Yeah.
which is always good. A lot of those places don't have a lot of drinking area, because it's, you know, expensive. As they have clustered, a lot of, I don't know if this is also true in your neck of the woods, a lot of the breweries around here are specifically in, like, corporate development.
Almost all ours are, too.
Right.
It's old office park space.
Right.
Because corporate real estate's kind of falling apart.
Right. So, yeah.
and I assume rents are fairly cheap at this point, so your overhead's pretty low.
Yeah. My buddy Jason Collins, Cypress Brewing in Edison, and yeah, they also keep buying the units, like, next to them and just knocking, whenever they need more space, they just buy another unit and knock some walls down.
Sure.
Apparently it's a lucrative industry if the beer is good, but the problem is that the beer has to be good.
Yeah, and most of the places that survive, the beer's good.
Right, the ones that last 2 months, the beer sucks, you know. And whether your beer is good or not is something that gets around very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, between, you know, Untappd and Beer Advocate and Yelp and those kinds of places. You know, we live that world.
That's our correspondence for this week, and now it is.
About in 29 minutes. We were part of the few.
Yeah.
One of them was that I registered with the Sirius Center website ahead of time. That was where a lot of on mobile.
Yeah, and everything else crashed.
Right, and everything else crashed. So, we actually have, like, really good seats. You know, we're sitting in the risers right by the ring. There's something to be said for the fact that they sold out 10,200 tickets in 29 minutes, despite the website. They scaled the building pretty not aggressively. You know, our tickets were, what, $53 for, a comparable ticket at NXT Brooklyn would have been three times as much money. A comparable ticket for SummerSlam would have been $300.
I mean, a comparable ticket for, like, Raw is more than that.
Yeah, you know, I had comparable tickets for the Royal Rumble, and I think they were, like, $250. And they were worse. My Raw After Mania tickets, I think, were like $100, and they were somewhere. It's something.
It is. It was one announced match.
You know, the only match they've announced is Cody Rhodes challenging the NWA champion, whomever it is. It's currently Nick Aldis, probably best known as Magnus. It may or may not be Nick Aldis on September 1st.
Well, who would you put the title on, then?
Put on anybody.
I know.
Well, the NWA's had deals with ROH, they've had deals with New Japan, so it's not like they're in on this whole conglomerate.
Sure.
Whatever. And, I mean, I assume the title's going for Cody.
You'd think.
You know.
It would give him sort of the, you know, the legacy
champ. Gives him
champ.
A little
credit
in Japan, and, you know.
Yeah, it's his father's title, too. So you have that.
Right.
You can probably work an angle off that.
Right. You know, I'm sure Corgan's doing business with ROH. And, you know, I think Magnus has shown up on ROH television recently, too. So
sure.
I know they had him as a face in the crowd at the WrestleMania weekend event. You know, they didn't. Any major announcement they made that wasn't previously known, but a lot of people had figured out, was Rey Mysterio for the show. And that had been heavily. They didn't announce CM Punk. They didn't announce. Although, essentially, given the talent that's working the show, you kind of like the. You know, the combinations here are just not.
Sure. I mean, they're basically saying, here's who's going to be on the show, trust us.
Young Bucks, Kazuchika Okada, Marty Scurll, Kenny Omega. And, you know, we've mentioned before, both in the context of the Young Bucks and Cody, that they've both been very, they've built brands with, like, the hardcore fan. So they have this built-in trust. So
right.
When they run this show, like, you're like, like, you know, you're getting 10,000 people, probably. I don't know, 8,000 are probably fly-ins, I would guess.
I'd assume somewhere in that vicinity.
You know, they've got the trust that's like, trust us, this isn't going to suck. It's a lot of people.
It is.
You know, ROH, with every wrestling fan in the known universe, and certainly out of these 10,000 people, probably 9,000 of them were in New Orleans for WrestleMania weekend. You know, ROH had the ability to open up more seats at the New Orleans Arena. They sold, you know, they put about 6,000 people in there. They maybe could have sold a few more tickets, but it wasn't, you know, they didn't turn a lot of people away. And that was with everybody in town already and having the announced Kenny Omega versus Cody Rhodes match, which was a really big match. And they didn't sell out the one they put tickets on sale initially. You know, they sold like 2,000 tickets on day one. They didn't sell 10,000 tickets on day one.
I mean, they also were competing against a bunch of other events, including NXT, so this is happening in a vacuum in its own. It does make a difference. I don't think it makes, you know, 5,000 tickets worth of difference, but...
Right, I mean, it's kind of remarkable that with largely the same crew, that these guys doing it on their own, like, almost, like, has more street cred than, like, the like what's theoretically the number two North American wrestling company.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, you know, they, yeah, they've got Okada and they've got Rey Mysterio, but...
I don't think Rey Mysterio, like, moved people to buy.
Rey Mysterio's a draw.
He is, but I still think it would have sold out without them announcing.
I mean, I'm assuming that most of the people who bought tickets had no idea that Rey Mysterio was on the card or decided to buy tickets beforehand anyway.
Yeah, right.
Like, I don't think Rey Mysterio... The way they announced Rey Mysterio probably didn't move tickets that much. But, I mean, there's something to be said here for the way they kind of built the grassroots promotion of the show over the last 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably something to be said for the drawing power of Cody Rhodes, of the Young Bucks, of Omega, of Okada.
Well, I mean, you just said that ROH was the number two North American promotion, but the actual one said that might be New Japan.
Right. And, you know, I almost wonder sometimes if Okada's a bigger deal in North America than he is in Japan. You know, in Japan, to the Japanese audience, it's probably their third most popular guy behind Naito and Tanahashi.
Yeah.
You know, he plays subtle heel a lot to that audience. They always draw with him on top.
Sure.
You know, obviously he's been the catalyst for, you know, a lot of this stuff drawing in the Japanese marketplace. New Japan actually named a European president today for the first time. It was the vice president of Coca-Cola Japan, who's actually Dutch. Probably not going to matter a substantial deal. But, you know, something to keep an eye on. But Okada is certainly bigger than Tanahashi in North America.
Yeah.
And probably bigger than Naito in North America, and probably substantially so. You know, I think that's part of, you know, why they've kept the title on him so long. Like, that title really does actually mean something. And when you just keep it, you know, we talked about this a little bit last week. 5.5 stars in the Wrestling Observer.
Yeah.
For the Okada Tanahashi 9, I think, or whatever. Yeah, I've lost count. Yeah, because it's 9, because they're now 4-3-2, I think. You know, he's... They've basically... He's been promoted the greatest wrestler on the planet, essentially. Presentation matters there. The fact that he always at the end beats guys with his...
We've discussed over and over on the show as it relates to WWE.
Right. Well, back in 2012, he beat guys with his move once and it never got kicked in. They've kind of made this progression where, as wrestlers, now sometimes it takes two Rainmakers or three Rainmakers or four Rainmakers.
Rainmakers.
Also, like, in losing these matches, like, the amount of Rainmakers it takes for a significant marker of where your actual star power is.
It was a big deal when Sabre took, I think, multiple ones.
Right. Like, that was like, oh my god, he needs, like, Desperation Rainmaker after Desperation Rainmaker to beat Zack Sabre. That continues Zack Sabre's push. That doesn't harm. When you have a guy like that, you can lose. It's the Goldberg thing. You can always lose the Goldberg. It was never going to, you know.
And it also, I think, sort of is telling the story about how desperate he's getting to hold on to the title at this point, too.
Right.
So when it's building to his inevitable loss, which might be against Omega in the 2-out-3 Falls match, who knows. But
yeah, you know, it might not be. It might be in 2021 at the Tokyo Dome to Hiromu Takahashi moving up from junior heavyweight.
Who knows,
like, you don't know, you know. It could be, you know, they could go in a lot of different directions. Omega certainly, they could put the title on Omega, they could put the title on Kota Ibushi, they could put the title on Naito at some point. There's always juice in one last Tanahashi title reign. You know, they could put the title on Zack Sabre Jr.
They could now.
You know, that he's now, again, you know, you can always put the title back on Minoru Suzuki if you want. They have a lot of guys. And somehow, even when they run, like, the Seiya Sonata or Bad Luck Fale main event, it still works.
Yeah.
You know. I'm sure we're due for a Hiroki Goto title challenge in here somewhere. But Okada means a lot to the American audience, and the fact that he's on this show, I think, is fairly substantially meaningful.
So here's an interesting argument I'll make. On those grounds, Okada is currently the biggest global star in wrestling.
It's just still John Cena.
Maybe it is. I'm not saying it's not, but
it's biggest star within his area of stardom. But if you walked up to 10 people at Monday Night Raw tomorrow, 6 of them aren't going to know who he is, and 2 of them are going to be like, oh, that Okado guy I see on, you know, Twitter occasionally.
Yeah.
Whereas if you went up to 10 people at All In, they'd all have very strong opinions about John Cena.
Do you think that's still true about the Raw audience, though?
Yeah. I mean, it's becoming less. And something that also happens is that there's enough people seated in that audience that, say, when AJ Styles shows up at the Royal Rumble, you know, it's a really big deal. And then when AJ Styles is immediately presented as a really big deal coming in, it helps him, you know.
Yeah.
And they've kind of recognized, you know, we've talked about this in the past, too, but Vince is unusually willing to recognize New Japan because, hey, that's like Inoki's promotion that we worked with for all those years.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Dragon's Gate a little less so.
Yeah.
I guess we're going All In.
Yeah, I guess. I'm sure there'll be more covered on the pod as matches are announced.
It'll be in Chicago over Labor Day weekend. Apparently, there were very few tickets actually sold to scalpers, so if you don't have tickets, you're probably not getting in.
It's kind of crazy.
Unless you want to buy, like, nosebleeds for, like, $200. Because that was the immediate response of, like, everybody who got locked out is, wow, there must have been lots of tickets scalped. There were not lots of tickets scalped. There's almost no... I mean, I'm going to go on StubHub here.
Yeah.
You know. Because an event like this, when it sells out immediately, the scalpers are throwing the tickets on StubHub and all those sites immediately. And,
yeah, because they know you're juiced up to go right now, so.
Right. There's 315 tickets on StubHub. Now, let's do a quick comparison. SummerSlam is sold out, too. SummerSlam has 4,200 tickets on StubHub.
It's like a quarter of them, probably.
Or, you know, you want to...
They set up for that, but...
NXT Brooklyn just got put on sale. We will not be at NXT Brooklyn. It's the same day as the Phillies event. If anybody's curious. NXT Brooklyn has 1,800 tickets, and it hasn't even officially went on sale yet.
Yeah.
It's only in the that's only off of the pre-sales. And, you know, that's going to... There will be a comp... You know, they'll put 10,000 people in the Barclays Center for NXT, and it's already got... You know, a fifth of the house is on there. There just are not a lot of tickets on the resale market for all in. These are actually people that want to go to the show. Which is more, you know, the immediate response is they should book the United Center, right? They should book the United Center and jacked every price by 100%.
Yeah.
But, you know, they... Over the course of the last year, as they were planning this, they came up with a very specific business plan with the exact size arena they wanted, the exact specifications they wanted, and the exact amount of money they needed to make. And they didn't jack ticket prices past that. And, you know, good for them. You know, it's... You know, I made this... joke to you already, but is Cody Rhodes now, like, the Wrestling Observer Promoter of the Year?
That's an argument.
That's not a bad argument either, you know. The person that's probably going to win is Paul Levesque for NXT, and this is a lot more successful than any NXT show's ever been, realistically. I mean, NXT can usually sell about this many tickets in their major arena shows tacked on to major wrestling pay-per-views.
Yeah.
You know, NXT was not sold out in Orlando. It wasn't sold out in Philly, you know, what they'd want, 9,000 in Philly, it's,
yeah.
It wasn't sold out last year in Brooklyn. They probably had 13,000, you know, 12 or 13,000.
Yeah.
You know, it did sell out in Dallas, but it sold out at 6,000 seat arena.
Yeah.
And that was also, like, one of those just, like, weird, you know, it was a soft sellout until they announced Shinsuke Nakamura versus Sami Zayn.
Yeah.
It wasn't NXT that sold that show out, yeah. It was Shinsuke Nakamura, which is another, you know, maybe nod to the idea that perhaps Kazuchika Okada is a much bigger star than we perceive him to be, that Shinsuke Nakamura could do that just based off of, you know... what he had been in, you know, essentially a lesser form of the same, you know, New Japan's gone substantially in the 2.5 years since then. Yeah, certainly in terms of an American audience. That actually shows us a lot of viewers. Yeah. They do more, you know, there's many people watching those horrible JR dubs of, you know, month-old New Japan matches that are watching, like, Impact.
Sure.
Or watching, like, ROH's weekly television. I guess technically I'm a member of Honor Club, so I could watch ROH's weekly television if it ever occurred to me to watch ROH's weekly television, but it's also not on any television station I actually get, so...
What you're saying, something, you get a lot of stations.
Yeah, I do. I guess, I mean, do we want to do 2 minutes on Backlash being the worst pay-per-view in, like, 5 years?
Was that last week? Oh, yeah, because we were podcasting during it. So I actually did end up turning it on for the...
Oh, God, it was so bad.
...main event.
So, first of all, Shinsuke Nakamura and AJ Styles go out there. Mm-hmm. This is going to be the one where they tear the house down.
Yeah, no DQ, they can...
So not only did they not tear the house down, they had their nice little TV match again. Folks, Shinsuke Nakamura can't go. It's time to admit it. Because AJ Styles, because you see AJ Styles can go. We know AJ Styles can go. This was the worst fucking finish. And like,
I got texts from Kate Feldman about it. I got
this is a no DQ street fight. They did a double count out inside the ring off of mutual nut shots.
Yes.
Like, I understand that, like, once every 10 years, you have to do a double count out inside the ring, so when the ref counts, people pay attention. You don't do it in a world title match that's supposed to be, like, the blow-off to your four-month-long feud that's kind of been somewhat underwhelming.
Yeah.
So, of course, it's not the blow-off. They're not getting this feud to fucking Money in the Bank now. What match are they going to have? Based on doing a double count-out finish, I'm assuming it's going to be a Last Man Standing match.
Sure.
And then... Now, this pay-per-view has already been going on for 4.5 hours. This match doesn't even go in the ring until, like, 11:15. And Samoa Joe fucking chinlocks Roman Reigns for 8 minutes.
Yeah.
This is after there was a women's match in between here that was terrible. Again, I mentioned this in passing last week. You can't sell me Women's Evolution at the same time you put your belt on Carmella. Because Carmella is every 2006... Carmella is Candice Michelle.
Sure.
And Carmella and Charlotte went out there and stunk the joint out. And then Roman Reigns and Samoa Joe went out there and stunk the joint out. And... apparently this one may have finally gotten through to Vince because it was finally the New York Metro audience that did it. You know, fuck you, Roman. Die, Roman, die.
Most of the crowd walked out.
Like, yeah, like 50% of the crowd walked out during the match. It got somewhat good at the end. They had some cute near falls.
Sure.
But and then at the end, Roman just fucking wins with his move.
That's how it usually works.
There's an interesting juxtaposition between All In selling 10,200 seats out of, you know, in 29 minutes to fans that literally couldn't get through on the phone, get through on the internet, to fans that paid hundreds and hundreds of dollars to see this, you know, backlash show just fucking walking out on the main event.
Yeah.
You know, and based on what the UFC contract just came in at, UFC signed a partial deal with ESPN for $150 million a year, which means they're going to sign another deal with somebody else for another $150
million.
Yeah. And WWE is probably going to be valued at least what UFC is. And if WWE gets a $300 million contract, they're never going to lose money again. You know, Vince McMahon's going to be so rich they can masturbate in the ring, which is essentially what they've been doing with this Roman Reigns push for 4 years. But, yeah, there's a juxtaposition there about, you know, it's just, and it's not a good look for WWE. It's just not. And they have guys. Seth Rollins is getting really hot again.
Sure. We got Strowman, obviously.
You know, Strowman's there. But they're just, I mean, they're tying Strowman down with this giant 290-pound anchor named Bobby Lashley. Which is just...
Yeah.
Because Bobby, you know, you look at Bobby Lashley, and Bobby Lashley's what Vince thinks is money.
Yeah.
And it ain't, you know... The money's not Bobby Lashley, money's Seth Rollins. And there's points where, you know, it looked like Rollins might be the guy, you know, when he came back from the knee injury initially. You know, there's points where it looked like it was going to be Dean Ambrose. There's points where it looked like it was going to be Braun Strowman. It ain't fucking Roman Reigns. It just ain't. It just ain't.
Well, we'll see if any lessons have been learned.
They haven't been.
They haven't
Ron been. Howard voice, they haven't been.
Next week, on another edition. For all you kids out there.